They took a large language model, which had basically been trained on human text, but then they trained another model on the outputs of the large language model. And then they did the same thing again. So they trained another model on the outputs of the second generation model. It led to something that they call model collapse. Basically, within about five generations, it's just producing gibberish. And what this tells you is that for all that the text that the original large language model was producing looks like human text, it has some qualities that human text doesn't.
Michael Wooldridge, welcome to How the Light Gets In Festival.
Thank you very much for the invitation to be here. It's a real pleasure.
So you're obviously Professor of Computer Science at the University of Oxford. And my first question would be, what initially drew you to the discipline of computer science and I guess more broadly within that artificial intelligence?
So I was of that generation that got exposed to home computers for the first time. So I was a 14-year-old in rural Herefordshire. Met some friends in Hereford town one day, and one of my friends told me there was a shop that was selling computers in Hereford, which I found completely implausible. It just seemed impossible at that time. So we wandered over to this shop, and indeed they were selling, it was a Tandy shop, a Radio Shack shop, and they were selling the first generation of home computers. We went in and the guys in the shop let us play on them, let us program them, and within a couple of weeks I was hooked. And so I was that first generation that really experienced home computers. So I then went on to study computer science. It was the only subject I was really interested in doing. And by my final year, I just got fascinated with artificial intelligence for the very simple reason. A lot of research fields that you go into are just very crowded and very overworked. You know, there's tiny little bit of space to work on and a huge number of people working on it. And in some sense, you're competing. With AI then and now, there are just huge open vistas. There are huge amounts of territory where nobody's gone. And I just loved that idea, the fact that you could just explore something and be the first person to explore that. And I say that was true then, and it still is true today. And I still get excited about AI in the same way that I did 35 years ago.
I'm curious to know how you would go about defining something like artificial intelligence, because people describe it in many different ways, applied linear algebra, applied statistics, or all these kind of definitions of what it actually is. So what would be your definition of artificial intelligence?
That's a very mean question to
ask,
because it's been debated. And when I say debated, it's been argued over for at least 70 years. And nobody owns AI. Everybody has their own view about it. There's one version of AI, which is not the version that I'm terribly interested in, but the one version of AI is that the goal of AI is to build the Hollywood dream, you know, machines that are as fully capable or more capable potentially of human beings, and maybe even machines that are conscious and autonomous and self-aware in the same way that you and I are. For me, that's not so interesting. I mean, I enjoy talking about it after a couple of glasses of wine, but it's not what gets me out of bed in the morning. What fascinates me about AI is the idea of machines which can do things which currently only human beings can do. So just extending the frontiers of what we can get machines to do. And one of the fascinating things about AI is that some things that we find trivial, or at least we don't associate with intelligence, are phenomenally difficult in AI terms. So, and the famous example is driverless cars. You know, somebody tells you they've got a driving license, you're not going to think, your first thought is not going to be, wow, this must be a really intelligent person, right? That's just a routine thing that we do, and most of us take it for granted. And yet, getting computers to drive cars is phenomenally difficult, and untold amounts of money have been spent trying to get computers that can safely and reliably drive cars. And then on the other hand, there are things that are trivial for computers that are phenomenally difficult for human beings. So doing mathematics, most people find doing mathematics to be, you know, a drudgery at best, or, you know, an immense irritation at worst. And people find it difficult, you know, they make lots of mistakes and so on. And yet computers can do that really quickly and reliably. And so I think there's this fascinating sort of dichotomy in AI about, you know, a lot of people are very confused when they move into the field that the things that they think are going to be difficult are actually not the things that really are difficult for AI. And that's one of the fascinations of the field.
What do you think are probably the most difficult things?
So historically, the things that have proved to be most difficult are tasks involving perception, basically. And by perception, I mean just understanding where you are and what's around you. So if we go to driverless cars again, So people have been trying to build driverless cars certainly since the end of the Second World War, with endless applications. And I say huge amounts of money have been spent on that. So what is the difficult thing about driverless cars? If you ask somebody this, you know, there is this scenario that I'm sure you've come across, the trolley problem, right? The trolley problem is this idea that you're driving along a road one day and there's a nun and a freckle-faced child and, you know, one of them must die. You're going to have to swerve and one of them's going to... So who do you kill? A mountain of paper has been generated discussing the trolley problem over the years. That sort of stuff is really a red herring, I think, in driverless cars. The big problem in driverless cars is knowing where you are and what's around you. Knowing that that's somebody on a bicycle, that that's a stop sign, that this is a lorry which is on the other side of the road, you know, that that's a pedestrian crossing. If you can solve reliably that problem, knowing where you are and what's around you, then you've solved driverless cars, basically. But that problem, which again, most of us just take completely for granted, we don't even realize it's an issue, turns out to be phenomenally hard for AI. And interestingly, that's where a lot of the progress has been over the last 15 years.
So in general, the sort of path towards AGI, I suppose, involves in some way endowing computers with this ability to have a conception of these higher order concepts. What do you see as the path of getting us to a point where a machine is capable of reasoning in the same kind of way?
So AGI, artificial general intelligence, is this idea that, roughly speaking, we'll have machines which are as fully capable as people are. And because we've seen progress in AI, and quite marked progress, I mean, step change progress in some areas of AI, that's led a lot of people to think that, well, perhaps now we're AGI must be really quite close at hand. But as always, there are lots of different versions of AGI. And if the version of AGI that you're interested in involves having machines which are in the physical world and that can operate in the physical world, in other words, that you could have, for example, a robot that you could just say, tidy up my house or cook me a meal to order or something like that, actually, that still feels like a long way into the future. I could be wrong. I've been wrong about many things in AI over the last few years, but that still feels like a long way in the future. Why? Because anything in AI that involves the physical world is just much, much harder. ChatGPT, I'm sure a lot of viewers of this video will have played with ChatGPT and may well have been really, really impressed with it. It's not in the physical world at all. It's a purely document-based, text-based system. It's read an awful lot of text, and that's where it acquires its intelligence from. But the intelligence that it has is nothing to do with the physical world. Unfortunately, ChatGPT can't tidy your house or cook a meal to order. And I say, and the technology there that's been so successful in ChatGPT and these large language models, as they're called, is nothing to do with robotic AI. It's completely disconnected from robotic AI.
And in terms of ChatGPT and large language models in general, do you think it would make sense to kind of see the system's behavior not as kind of like competence without comprehension, but maybe like a new form of understanding or reasoning that is not limited or accessible to human beings?
Competence without comprehension. I think that's an Alan Turing. Yes. I think it goes back to Alan Turing and absolutely nails it. ChatGPT doesn't understand anything. All ChatGPT is doing is when you give it a piece of text, it's trying to predict what the next piece of text should be. And it's essentially doing some fancy statistics is what it boils down to, although a statistician might argue with me about that. But let's call it some fancy statistics. And it's working on the basis of having seen an enormous amount of pre-existing text. It's not in any meaningful sense understanding. You know, when you're having a conversation with ChatGPT, however dazzling it is, there is no mind on the other end. And so going back to the idea of it being in the world, if you're in the middle of a conversation with ChatGPT and you get up and go on holiday for a couple of weeks, it's not wondering where you are. It's not wondering anything at all. It's not aware of the passage of time because it isn't in the world at all. It's a computer program which is just paused in a loop waiting to read the next piece of text that you would give it. And you give it the next piece of text when you get back from your holiday and it is not aware of the passage of time at all. You know, it's disembodied from the world. So it's a fundamentally different kind of intelligence. Now, for me, if we ever succeed in AGI, a version of AGI which was not capable of doing something trivial like tidying up my house is a very uninteresting version of AGI. But there may be versions of general intelligence which don't involve the physical world, which are in the relatively near future.
You once said that the limits to computing are the limits of your imagination. Could you explain a little bit more about what you mean by that statement?
So if you're an engineer, or you want to build houses, you want to build bridges, then the limits that are imposed on you are the limits of physical materials, the limits of steel, the limits of concrete, the limits of brick, and, you know, the forces of nature that surround you. But computer programs are thought stuff. I mean, you know, your imagination allows you to create something completely new. And so somebody with a good idea in computing can still transform the world today very, very easily. Nice example, my colleague Tim Berners-Lee, you know, who invented the World Wide Web, you know, and that was just his idea. He created the entire thing. He had the entire vision for the World Wide Web, created the entire thing and transformed the world. And that was one person not that long ago that could do that. And it was just because he had the vision, and obviously he had the technical skills, but he had that idea to make it happen. And that's one of the reasons I love computer science. It's one of the reasons that I love AI. The limits to computing are not the physical limits of concrete and steel. It's your imagination. And if you can still create something fundamentally new.
Do you think that this calls on us to maybe reconceive how we think about maybe power in general in society? If a software engineer or a computer scientist can change the world, in my opinion, in such a fundamental way as something like the World Wide Web and the creation of these technologies has such a huge impact on society, I mean, how do you consider this kind of creative power maybe vis-a-vis governments or sovereign states?
So there is a concern that's out there, which I can completely relate to and understand and somewhat share, which is that particularly with AI, the only actors at the moment that can build a ChatGPT level product are a very small number of big tech companies and sovereign states with the will and the resources to be able to do so. And that means that that power at the moment is being vested in a rather small number of groups. One issue for the UK is whether the groups that are wielding that power have UK interests in mind. And some of them might do, but some of them I think certainly don't. So I think there is definitely an issue, which is, you know, it certainly is receiving national attention. The UK now has a national AI task force. And I think my understanding, at least, is that part of their mission is to address that question. What should a sovereign AI capability look like? Should the UK have the capability to operate in that space independently of foreign-owned big tech companies? So that's a big ongoing debate, and it's going to be fascinating to see how that pans out.
I'm also curious to know what you think about the kind of trade-off that seems to be prevalent between performance of these systems and then their interpretability. So with something like you know, ChatGPT or the kind of what underpins deep learning in general is a large amount of compute and a large amount of data, but the algorithm itself is sort of becomes somewhat inexplicable. I'm curious to know if you think that, you know, if scale is all we need and as these systems scale, will their interpretability become even harder? And if so, what does that mean for how we think about how these systems interact with the world more broadly and how we kind of put systems in place to make sure that they impact the world in the way that we want and that they benefit society if they are rendered more and more inexplicable?
Yeah, so this is one of the defining AI problems of our time, interpretability, and the fact that these machine learning technologies, in particular neural networks, are inherently black boxes. So what does that mean? So a neural network inspired by the microstructure of the brain, but doing in some sense something somewhat similar to what the brain does, but in software. If the human brain has something like 100 billion or so neurons, there are no precise figures, connected to one another in enormous networks. And neural networks researchers use a somewhat related idea. And now, suppose you train a neural network to recognize faces. And actually, every time you upload a picture of yourself to social media and you label it with your name, that's what you're doing. You're literally feeding the machine learning algorithms of the big tech companies. Now, suppose at some point, I become unhappy about the idea that, you know, some big tech company can recognize my face, because they've seen my picture on the How the Light Gets In website or something like that, and they've learned to be able to recognize my face. And I go to them and I say, okay, I don't want you to be able to recognize my face anymore. With neural networks, you can't point at the bit of the network that recognizes Michael Wooldridge. That just isn't the way that that technology works. That recognition process is somehow embedded in this enormous network. And so you can't snip out that kind of capability. And more generally, we don't, in a deep sense, really understand how they're working. It's slightly embarrassing truth. I mean, we kind of understand the mathematics in some sense, but actually, why is ChatGPT, in a precise sense, so capable of what it's doing? Or actually, what can it do? We don't really understand. And there's a vast flurry of work right now to try to get to the bottom of those questions. It feels like we're a way off from getting to the bottom of those questions. So interpretability, I think, really is an issue. But it has concrete implications. You know, if you're unhappy about what a machine learning algorithm knows about you, there is no way to simply snip that out. It's not there in a database where they can just delete the record from the database. That isn't the way the technology works.
It's especially worrying when AI-driven decision-making processes come to influence society in ways in kind of, you know, who is more likely to commit recidivism, or, you know, who gets a loan application. These are ethical. These questions have an ethical dimension that are almost impossible to kind of understand why those decisions are being made. So when people have recourse to, or want recourse to understand why a decision has been made and it can't be given, do you think that we should stop using AI-driven decision-making in these instances?
So I think that there's a distinction to make between decision-making and decision support.
Yeah.
In situations where human beings are affected by the decisions, and be extraordinarily cautious about using AI directly to make decisions. A classic example is in Durham. The Durham police developed a tool which basically was advising on whether somebody should be held in custody or not. So somebody would be brought into a police station, and the custody officer would have to make the decision about whether to retain them in a cell overnight or not. And the decision, I presume, would be based on, are they going to reoffend? Are they going to harm themselves? Are they going to harm anybody else? Those sort of are the factors. And a human being, a custody officer, an experienced custody officer, would have to make that judgment call. So they train neural networks on an enormous number of records going back a number of years about cases where, you know, people being released turned out to be a bad idea, and the idea is the AI learns to be able to make that judgment call. Now, as it happens, the Durham police, it was a very responsible experiment as far as AI experiments go, and they were very clear that this was not going to be making a decision. It was going to be another voice in the room. My worry is that human factors come into play. And firstly, the evidence is that people will tend to just listen to the computer recommendation and be steered by it. But also, you know, imagine you've got a custody officer who's had a very long shift, who's tired, you know, who's had to deal with a series of difficult cases previously. And, what are they going to do if the program says release them? Are they going to argue with that decision? Are they going to go to make the mental effort of thinking up reasons why they should disagree with that decision? And then in 20 years' time, if the tool is still being used, how are the people going to view it then? You know, that actually after 20 years of use, it may well be that the custom and practice is just to listen to what the AI said. So my recommendation is basically, in situations where human beings are going to be materially affected by a decision, the AI can be a voice in the room, but you should be extraordinarily cautious about actually having the AI take the decision or make an action.
The transformer obviously has led to this almost Cambrian explosion in generative AI technologies. I'm curious to know what you think about this particular inflection point and how you think generative artificial intelligence in general will impact society.
So I think I historically, and when people have talked about, you know, big advances in AI, my gut reaction has always been to say, calm down, you know, don't get too excited. You know, this is interesting stuff, but, you know, it's manage your expectations a little. I think my reaction to what we've seen over the last few years, with the advent of what's called the Transformer architecture from Google in I think 2017, and then the way that that architecture, that generative AI architecture, which is to do with predicting tokens, it's a predictive architecture, but it turns out you can use it for generating text, basically for generating very plausible text. That architecture, coupled with enormous amounts of training data and enormous amounts of computer power, has delivered systems like ChatGPT and Bard and Lambda, which are enormously impressive. And I think what we saw when I first became aware of this was June 2020. We were all still in a kind of semi-lockdown and we were all very scared about leaving our front doors. But GPT-3 was released by OpenAI, or announced. And the examples that they released to demonstrate this, they almost seemed too good to be true. It seemed implausible that they could actually be that good. But as people got to experience it and to play with it, and this is the immediate predecessor of ChatGPT, so you just have a conversation with it, and you can ask it about, you know, the relative merits of Liverpool Football Club versus Man United, or the history of quantum physics, or the life and works of Winston Churchill. You can ask about all of that kind of stuff, and it seemed to be extremely impressive and very fluent, and then you could ask it to do that in the style of a Shakespearean sonnet, and wow, it would do it. That felt like a step change. That felt like genuinely, in a way that we haven't really seen in AI very often, it felt like we'd moved a long way in a very short period of time. What we've seen since then, and in particular the release of ChatGPT in, I think, November 2022, and of course it goes viral and famously becomes the fastest adopted online tool in history, etc., etc., I think really that is genuinely a technological watershed moment. There is pre-GPT and post-GPT. I do wish they'd found a better acronym than GPT, I have to tell you. But there is pre-GPT and post-GPT. And exactly the same way that there was pre-World Wide Web and post-World Wide Web, that things, that history forked at that point. What we're going to see is, and what we are seeing, is an enormous number, exactly as you say, a Cambrian explosion of applications of this technology. What's ironic, I think, is that in an awful lot of cases, people won't even realize they're dealing with AI. One of my perpetual frustrations when we talk about examples of AI, and I say, you know, somebody says, give me an example of AI that I use every day, or that people use every day. So Google Translate, or one of the many automated translation tools, it's one of the modern miracles of the world. For me, it's up there with Apollo 11. And people don't even realize it's AI. You know, this thing which is one of the ancient dreams of humanity. And in exactly the same way, generative AI is just going to be embedded everywhere. So in your word processor, you'll be able to select a paragraph of text, and one of the options will just be polish this text, turn it into nice prose, or summarize it, give me a 100-word summary, or extract the top 3 bullet points from this, and bang, it will do it. And behind the scenes, there will be large language models, generative AI doing that. But in a very short period of time, people will just regard it as routine, and they won't regard it as AI at all. It's going to be everywhere.
Do you ever worry that the kind of climate under which these technologies are being developed will lead to inimical outcomes for people?
So, artificial intelligence became clear that things were really moving forward around about 2005 or so. And then one of the big breakthroughs when it really became clear that there was progress was 2012. And there was a program called AlexNet, which was, again, one of the breakthrough moments in AI. And when it became clear that AI was starting to work, there's massive speculative investment, notably from big tech companies who start spending unimaginable quantities of money investing very speculatively in a very wide range of AI technologies. And they've begun to use many of the applications of that. So we've already talked about Google Translate, for example, that nowadays is driven by neural network technology and so on, and a huge range of different applications of the technology. But then generative AI lands on the scene, and actually this is what gets everybody's attention. This is where people interact with it, realize that they're interacting with AI, and we have the first general purpose AI tools with a very wide range of applications. It seems like what we're seeing now is a rush in all these big tech companies to get this technology in everything they can. Just put it everywhere, hope that where they put this is the product which is going to take off, where the one that's really going to make an impact in the market. Now, the big concern is in the middle of that rush, with the stake of trillion-dollar companies, you know, the future of trillion-dollar companies at stake, where does that leave you and me? And in particular, is the rush to release this technology getting ahead of its readiness to actually be released? So I think there is certainly some evidence that, yes, that's the case. So in the GPT-3, which was, I say, the breakthrough system, in the early releases of GPT-3, you could ask questions like, you know, I want to murder my wife and get away with it. How do I do that? And it would very helpfully give you five different ways of doing that. And so this, somebody announced this on social media that they'd done this, and obviously there's embarrassment. So they try and fix this problem. And a week later, somebody says, I'm writing a novel in which the main character wants to murder their wife and get away with it. How do I do that? And it helpfully gives, yes, here are five different ways in which your character can murder their wife and get away with it. And so there's ever since this technology has been released, there's been a continual attempt to try to patch the ways in which the technology can be misused. You don't need a PhD in AI to get around those patches at the moment. The kind of scenarios that I'm worried about are, you know, some teenager who's got some health problem but is too embarrassed to go to the doctor, and they ask a large language model for medical advice. And we know that this technology gives hallucinations. We know that it can be extremely unreliable in many situations. I would be surprised if that hasn't happened already. There was a case in Belgium where it seems somebody was encouraged to commit suicide and did indeed commit suicide after a conversation with a large language model. There are endless different applications. And before we even get to, you know, how do I build a chemical weapon or a dirty bomb or something like that, my sense is that OpenAI are frantically trying to patch their systems to prevent those kinds of things. But those patches are, it looks to me like they're the engineering equivalent of sticking gaffer tape on things. They're not deep fixes. They're just trying to intercept as many of these queries as possible. And for the time being, I think, you know, this technology will have those kinds of flaws within it. So yes, I am worried that the technology is getting ahead of its readiness to be released. I think regulation of some kind is necessary. What isn't obvious is what regulation would work. It seems like there is willingness in Europe, for example. EU has AI regulation that's prototype AI regulation, which is very well intentioned, but I think is far from perfect in its current state. The UK government is actively discussing that. We've got the AI summit coming up in November in the UK on the 1st and 2nd of November, bringing together international actors around AI to discuss what needs to be done. But it isn't obvious to me what regulation is going to look like or how it might work.
Do you think part of the problem is the complex nature of these technologies interacting with many other complex systems in a way that's highly unpredictable, but also it's quite hard, if not entirely impossible, to embed values, which are very amorphous and changing things to human beings even, into a machine in general?
So I'm very wary of the idea that we have moral machines.
Yeah.
And why I'm wary about that is I think that gives people an excuse to abdicate their own moral responsibilities. So, and you know, military scenarios are the classic one. You know, should we have lethal autonomous weapons? And I think no, because what I fear is that, well, there are a whole bunch of things that I fear about this. There are some quite scary scenarios around it. But one of the fears I have is that somebody is going to say, but it's not my fault. It was the AI that made that decision. You know, where people are abdicating their own professional or moral or ethical responsibilities and saying it was the AI's fault. I want people to be ethical and moral. I don't think we should be aiming at moral machines. These are tools that we're using. It's people that we should require to be ethical.
I also just did want to ask, obviously your most recent book, A History of AI, What It Is, Where We're Going, Where We Are, you make the claim that problems requiring human-level intelligence are, you know, producing genuine art, communicating with a person, are kind of far from being solved. This was obviously before the release of ChatGPT that many would claim are able to do these things. I'm curious to know what you think about the kind of divergence between AI that's developed in industry and academia, and the relationship between the two, and whether kind of development in AI is maybe consigned to industry.
So the reality of contemporary AI is that no university, no academic body could create a product like ChatGPT at the moment. The scale of resources you need, the data, the computer power you need to be able to do that is way beyond academia. That has way beyond the public sector at the moment. The UK public sector can't do that. That I think is worrying for all sorts of reasons. I, as an academic, I find it uncomfortable. But as a UK citizen, I also find it uncomfortable that actually this technology is being developed and operated by foreign-owned companies. So that raises a whole bunch of issues in its own right. How does it change AI for academics, for people like me who've been working in it for a long time? So when I was a PhD student, sorry, this is one of those old men stories, apologies for that, but when I was a PhD student, you know, I didn't even have a computer on my desk. I shared a computer with half a dozen other people, and it was crude beyond imagining. My Apple Watch has got far more computer power than the desktop computer. You could innovate in AI in those days with just a desktop computer. That's ancient history. Where it's much more like now the situation in particle physics, where you need big resources in order to be able to do that. And I think that's a plausible model in just exactly the same way that we have international facilities like CERN for particle physics, that we should have national or international facilities around AI, so that we're not just required to use software which is developed behind the closed doors of Silicon Valley, where actually we can scrutinize the code, scrutinize the data, and get to use it. But to go back to your original question, firstly, I think we are still some way from having AI that's human level in a meaningful sense. Secondly, for all that I am genuinely impressed with ChatGPT and for all that I genuinely think they are breakthroughs, you don't have to play with them very long to find out their flaws. And every day I see a constant stream of scientific articles as well as social media posts which point out the hilarious ways in which they get things wrong. And ultimately, I say at the moment, the big barrier is the physical world. Robotic AI is a long, long way behind what ChatGPT is. And it's very, you know, it's easy to believe when you play with ChatGPT that the whole of AI must be at the same level. It really isn't.
You know, ChatGPT and these models have benefited hugely from the vast, vast amounts of data that's simply been scraped off the internet. Some people even kind of claiming we're sort of reaching the limits of sort of natural data that's produced by human beings. Really quickly, I'm curious to know what you see as the role of synthetic data going forward.
So synthetic data is going to be important for a number of reasons. And one of the reasons is that, for example, if you're interested in an AI program which has to deal with health records, for example, then there are natural concerns about giving over that data to health about real people to AI. So what you want is synthetic data, but synthetic data is very difficult. Realistic synthetic data turns out to be quite difficult to produce. With text, one of the really interesting, a recent paper, the name of it escapes me, there was a recent paper co-written by one of my colleagues, Yaren Gal, in Oxford. And what they did is they took a large language model, which had basically been trained on human text, but then they trained another model on the outputs of the large language model, and then they did the same thing again. So they trained another model on the outputs of the second generation model and looked to see what happens. And it led to something that they call model collapse. Basically, within about five generations, it's just producing gibberish. And what this tells you is that for all that the text that the original large language model was producing looks like human text, it has some qualities that human text doesn't. Now, that, I think, is absolutely fascinating.
That is fascinating.
Outcome. That has all sorts of implications. In 100 years' time, probably there's going to be vastly more AI-generated content, not just text, but text, music, audio, spoken word, video, and virtual reality. Vastly more AI-generated content out there than human-generated content. But if this stuff is no good to train AI on, then it's going to be very interesting indeed.